So how did the audience that Maria Callas was singing for hear her in the nosebleed seats? Artists think a lot about that. In 2010, David Byrne gave a presentation to the TED conference on the way that the venues where music is played actually inspire and influence the music played in them. You hear it when you attend an opera and sit in the nosebleed seats, because despite the great distance, you can still hear what's happening on the stage. It's the result of a painstaking process that combines physics, engineering, and perhaps a little bit of luck and common sense, and it's the subject of a new book that examines the innovative new concert halls popping up around the globe today. The book is called Sight and Sound, S-I-T-E and Sound, The Architecture and Acoustics of New Opera Houses and Concert Halls. It's published by the Monticelli Press, and I'm pleased to welcome its author, Victoria Newhouse, to our show today, along with composer and music critic Raphael Mostel and Carl Rosenberg, an acoustician with Accentech. Is it Accentech?
Yes.
Okay. I don't know where the accent or the ascent goes there, a company that provides acoustic consulting to architects. Welcome to our show.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Victoria, you say that the design of Greek theaters was inspired by this premise. If the source of a sound is reasonably close and can be seen, then that sound should normally also be audible. Were the Greek theaters the first spaces built that prioritized acoustics?
As far as I know, I must say today, the whole question of what you call the nosebleed seats are somewhat at odds with the Greek idea of being able to see.
People have to bring opera glasses in some cases.
Right. Well, I think that the very, very large opera houses are very much out of style today. And certainly all of the new concert halls and opera houses that I visited in my research for the book are considerably smaller than they would have been a generation ago.
Raphael, those ancient theaters were all open air, exposed to the elements. Don't musicians and composers typically dislike outdoor theaters because it's so difficult to control acoustic conditions?
Well, it depends where it is outdoors. If the acoustics are right, it can be absolutely as good as the best indoor spaces. Conversely, it could also be terrible. It depends entirely on the space itself.
So would it be better in a desert environment than in a city like New York, where it can rain on any given night?
Rain? Well,
having inclement
weather is not conducive for a happy audience most of the time. So that's not really an acoustic consideration. But the shifting sands of the desert might be problematic, but the sound carries very well in the dry environment. So it might actually be a good place to hear music. I don't know. I haven't heard many concerts in the deserts.
Carl, how do the acoustics of the Greek amphitheaters compare to the concert halls that we visit today? Are the Hollywood Bowl and the Pritzker Pavilion in Chicago's Millennium Park based on similar principles?
Well, outdoors, sound goes one direction and one direction only. Once you build an enclosure, the sound sounds quite different. So the same work performed at the Hollywood Bowl is going to sound different from in a concert hall, where the sound is reflected from all the different surfaces. So somewhat paradoxically, the sound in the nosebleed sections can be very, very exciting, very loud, because all the surfaces in the room are designed to reflect sound back up to that location.
But not overwhelm the people in the front rows.
That's correct.
I've heard that acoustical design was largely guesswork at first. Is that still true?
No, I certainly wouldn't be one to say that. We know a lot about the way sound works in buildings, how it reflects and is absorbed from different surfaces, what the sound fields are like. And it's based on scientific principles.
Victoria, at what point did acoustic architecture become more of a real science?
Well, I would like to go back a question and address the question. The
you can
idea.
Jump in. By the way, you can jump in any time if you want to add something to what somebody else has said.
Well,
don't mind me.
The idea. No. I do mind you. I think your questions are very thought provoking, but I don't totally agree that with Carl that acoustic engineering is a science. Nor do I agree with those who feel that it is totally an art and totally unpredictable. I think the truth probably lies somewhere in between. I think there's a lot of imponderables. And just to add something to the outdoor question, we now have a really state-of-the-art acoustical architecture, which in venues like, for example, Frank Gehry's new concert hall in Miami Beach recreates the sound outdoors almost as if you're sitting in the concert hall.
My guests are Victoria Newhouse, Carl Rosenberg, and Raphael Mostel. We're talking about the ideas that are presented in a book called Sight and Sound, The Architecture and Acoustics of New Opera Houses and Concert Halls, published by the Monticelli Press. This is WNYC, WNYC.org.
Jump in there? On the extraordinary Gehry building in Miami, the New World Symphony, the outdoor sound is entirely electronic. It's using the latest electronics to broadcast what's happening inside the hall. So you have the same kind of positioning, but it is a reproduction of the sound.
But we've often wondered why instrument makers today can't duplicate the Stradivarius sound, and also why some of the great old buildings seem to have better acoustics than more modern concert halls and opera houses. I remember the Metropolitan Opera House on West 39th Street as being one of the greatest places acoustically ever, and then the new Met isn't anywhere near up to it. You would have thought that people would have known.
Can I offer a disappointment? I was a baby when the Met went away, the old Met. But it was a very dry hall in the cheap seats where I was. And they had all of that velvet which absorbed the sound. So I remember a very dry sound without.
Okay, let's say La Scala. There are plenty of old buildings.
It's also a difference of scale because the Met Opera is the largest opera house in the world by a huge margin. It's about twice the size of most opera houses.
If you refer to some of the more classic traditional halls that are mentioned in Victoria's book that were built over 100 years ago, the acoustics are outstanding. They're phenomenal. People love those halls. Keep in mind that, for better or worse, the actual construction types were limited. You could not span very far. You had to build in order to cover the area. Today's architecture can have incredibly wide spans. And the advent of structural changes that allowed for fan-shaped halls, for instance, were exploited, perhaps detrimentally. But one of the reasons that we don't build the way we used to is we don't have to. So architects are challenged to make halls wider and wider and wider, which may be quite exciting and increase the seating capacity, but change the acoustics dramatically. So the old halls, because of the way they had to be built, had some built-in advantages.
And then you're making the point also that size plays an important role in how the sound is reflected and whether we're going to hear it as well. If it's in one of those fan-like buildings, if we're in the back row on the very end, it's going to be quite different than if we're in the middle.
Right.
But there's also some aspects of these wonderful old halls that we don't think about, which is that they're wonderful for the music that was composed at the time they were built. And maybe for some earlier music, they don't work as well for contemporary music, for example. I heard Esa-Pekka Salonen conduct one of his own pieces at the Musikverein in Vienna a couple of years ago, and it was extremely disappointing. It sounded very, very different from the way his music sounds when he performed it at Disney Hall.
And then, of course, we all know music through recordings, and recordings sound quite different than live performances as well. Many people prefer the live performance because there is something. I'm not sure whether it's because the sound is better. It just feels like it's better.
And recording technology changes too. So what is great for one generation, I'll bet if you went back to the old Met today, you wouldn't find it as great as you did when you experienced it originally.
I was also very young, so yeah. What did I know? You say, Victoria, after the Greeks, it was the Romans who helped evolve the outdoor theaters into something that more closely resembles the venues we use today. What did they bring to the table?
Well, they brought the odium, which had started initially under the Greeks, but the Romans certainly refined it. And those were halls that looked very much like a raked concert hall would look today, and that we think were used primarily for music.
When did the classic horseshoe design become popular for indoor concert halls and opera houses?
Well, that's a very interesting question, because in fact the horseshoe was developed in mid-17th century. And what I find as a historian absolutely extraordinary is that it's still being used today. So you have concert halls, or you have opera houses, like, for example, the new opera house in Oslo, which cost almost $1 billion to build, which is incredible on the outside. It's so innovative. It's so striking. People promenade on the roof. The interior could have been built 300 years ago.
Mm-hmm. Because they are imitating what was done.
They are reproducing for acoustical reasons, because they're terrified that they're going to spend $1 billion and people aren't going to be able to hear what's going on.
How much did the architects were there engineers of 300 years ago? How much did they actually know about what they had to do to make the sound true?
I don't know, Carl.
Well, I think they knew they wanted to keep people close. That's one of the reasons for the derivation of the horseshoe. It keeps a lot of people close to the stage, and that if the hall got too big, people wouldn't be able to see. So there were some natural considerations, plus, as I say, some structural elements, the materials that were used, and they had some models to build on.
Raphael, some musicians and critics have claimed that traditional-looking venues like Symphony Hall in Boston or Musikverein Hall in Vienna conjure ideas of more traditional-sounding music. Do you think that playing in a less conventional space inspires a less conventional approach to the music itself?
Oh, absolutely. I think that for creative musicians, it's a wonderful challenge to meet a building that is not presenting the standard concert setup. And how do you engage that kind of building with sound is just a wonderful challenge. I mean, through history, there have been a lot of different examples. Going back to Monteverdi, we were just celebrating the 400th anniversary of the Vespers of 1610. It was inspired by San Marco in Venice, that all of those double choir things, or the experiments with spatial separation of the musicians, or Berlioz in the 19th century.
Well, I imagine Bach composing for organs that were built into the churches.
That was to the specific organs themselves. Mm-hmm. Zilbermann was his favorite designer of organs, and he went whenever Zilbermann installed an organ, he would travel to the church to play it. But those were minor changes. Talking about addressing non-standard space, you have a whole alternative history of music that goes back quite far, of musicians who are engaging different kinds of spaces with all sorts of different musical ideas, myself included, but there are many, many others.
Well, I've always thought of composers as thinking about whoever commissioned the work, but mm-hmm. not where it's going to be performed.
Well, occasionally it does happen that it is part of the commission. One of the things in Victoria's book that she focuses on is the Phillips Pavilion in the 1958 World's Fair, which was commissioned as an advertisement for Phillips Electronics. And part of the original idea, correct me if I'm wrong, was that Le Corbusier wanted to have Edgar Varèse as part of the original thing. And then Le Corbusier had Yannis Xenakis working in his office. So the three of them came up with this incredible, innovative solution.
So what happens when people are not Varèse? Still sound good?
Not always, no. It's like any music. You know, some of it is more successful than others.
My guests are composer and music critic Raphael Mostel, Carl Rosenberg, who's an acoustician, and Victoria Newhouse, who has written a book called Sight and Sound, The Architecture and Acoustics of New Opera Houses and Concert Halls, which is published by the Monticelli Press. And if you're interested in seeing some images of the concert halls we're talking about, we have a slideshow on our show page at WNYC.org. We are back with Victoria Newhouse, author of a new book called Sight and Sound, The Architecture of Acoustics of New Opera Houses and Concert Halls. It's published by the Monticelli Press. It's a large format book with lots of fabulous pictures in it, and diagrams and architectural drawings and the like. And also with us is composer and music critic Raphael Mostel and Carl Rosenberg, an acoustician with Ascentec, a company that provides acoustic consulting to architects. Victoria, you credit the Berlin Philharmonie as one of the first concert halls that radically changed the way we think about concert halls. Structurally speaking, what's different about it?
Well, what is different is that the audience is arranged around the stage instead of on one side of it.
So this is like theater in the round?
It's like theater in the round, and this was, as far as I know, the first time that this configuration was introduced for classical music. I think that if there is a single buzzword for performing arts theaters today, it's intimacy. And I think that the performing arts, like the visual arts, are trying to engage audiences. They're looking for participation, not just handing over something that is pre-cooked, so to speak. And this, putting the audience around the performers, closer to the performers, so that they can see each other, members of the audience, and the musicians better, instead of looking at the backs of heads, is a step in that direction.
But, Carl, wouldn't that also affect the sound? If I am near the string section or near the brass section, wouldn't I be hearing them in an unbalanced way?
Yes. But it's a different...
Is that a good thing?
Well, it's a different kind of sound. It might depend on what you like and what you're used to and what other factors, such as the immediacy, the intimacy that Victoria mentioned, are more important to you. And so it's not a simple acoustical issue, because you'll hear something different from someone who's in a different other part of the hall.
Ed, could I jump in there? In traditional halls, you have the same situation where you have the people in the front of the orchestra usually facing the strings of the orchestra, and then the wind players and the brass and the percussion are in the back. So you have that difference of balance from the people who are further back in the hall. Same kind of balance question.
The only people you hear the same no matter where are the people who are doing percussion. Now, Victoria, the Philharmonie was located within view of the Berlin Wall. You say that it helped begin a new trend where venues unite performers, the public, and the political environment?
Well, you have to remember that Berlin had been divided, East Berlin and West Berlin, with a very, very strict political division. And so this idea of bringing people together in a theater was symbolic of, the hope that this great city would be again reunited.
Well, were people from East Berlin invited to come over? Wasn't it hard to get across?
I don't know. I think it was more conceptual, simply the idea that people were gathered in a more intimate and more participatory way. Whether they actually came from East Berlin, I doubt, frankly. It started a trend.
Well, it was built around the same time at Lincoln Center.
1963. It opened in 1963. And the new Jean Nouvel concert hall for the Danish Broadcasting Company in Copenhagen is modeled directly on the Berlin Philharmonie, and it's a gorgeous concert hall. using the same configuration referred to generally as a vineyard configuration, because the architect Hans Scheroen thought of this as a valley where the stage is, and then the vineyards on the hills surrounding it.
I just wanted to point out that the siting of the hall was deliberately in your face to the other half of Berlin, because it's on the bank of the Spree, and everybody from the other side of Berlin could see this extraordinary building going up. And so it was very well known what was going on.
Now, as I pointed out, it was built around the same time as Lincoln Center, and that campus has come under critical scrutiny since it was built. Is it because of the social implications of its design that it walls off the city around it?
I think so.
Or do you think that there are the acoustical complications?
Well, I think both, but I think social is very, very important. I mean, you have to remember that Lincoln Center was built at a time when the arts were sacred. They were considered something apart, something to be revered. Today, we don't think of the arts that way. We think of the arts as part of everyday life.
So this is a kind of an acropolis in New York.
Yes, that's correct. That's correct. And I think that's just the opposite of what we want today.
But then how did they get the acoustics so wrong? After all, there had been some pretty great concert halls and opera houses that the acousticians had to draw upon, didn't they?
Are we going to, I hope, have another show on that topic? Because it really has multiple dimensions and issues. But we're learning from those experiences.
Maybe we could focus on Philip Johnson.
Well, Philip Johnson admits in print, or certainly in the oral history, which has been printed out and which I consulted for my book, that he had no idea what was wanted. I mean, he had an orchestra pit in what is now called the Koch Theater that was a fraction of the size of what was needed. And he admits that nobody really talked to him about what was needed.
Maybe they should speak to Mitt Romney and get some of that money back.
From
the Cokes. not only did he not know what was needed, he did things that were absolutely no-nos. The proscenium, the original proscenium, was parabolic, so that I have these nightmare memories of going to performances there where singers, if they would step to the wrong part of the stage, all of a sudden their voice would shoot around the proscenium. These crazy.
And then in Avery Fisher Hall, musicians complained about their inability to hear what was happening on the other side of the stage.
That was a huge problem of the original design of the building. But to go back to an earlier point, when you're talking about projecting to the nosebleed, the idea of getting the sound up there, that the original acoustics of Philharmonic Hall before it was renovated to Avery Fisher Hall, were pretty much the same as they are now, except for the stage acoustics. The best sound in Avery Fisher Hall is in the top of the balcony, which is what it was like in the original Philharmonic Hall design.
Now, I've been on the stages of any number of venues where I've interviewed people, and sometimes it's very difficult for me to hear people who are not all that far away from me. I'm hoping the audience is hearing them. Is that because we're being mic'd, or because these stages were designed for people to hear in the audience but not necessarily sitting next to each other?
For my taste, bad design. The people on the stage have to hear each other, because if you're going to have musicians performing with each other, they have to know what the others are playing.
But I think the conditions for a speaker on stage are quite have different demands than what you'd have for a chamber group, for an orchestra. So it's not a simple answer to a question like that.
Well, Carl, temporary fixes have been going on at Lincoln Center throughout its history. Acousticians added sound baffles to the stage walls in Avery Fisher Hall in 1992 because of complaints from the musicians. Can you describe what those baffles look like and whether they really do help the sound?
They're designed to provide a different time pattern for the reflections that occur on stage, and they'll distribute the sound in a different manner.
So when somebody calls you and says, "We're having problems with the acoustics in our hall," what do you suggest? How do you go about figuring things out?
Well, a lot of listening and looking and some measurements too, but I think the most valuable input comes from the users of the space, what they're hearing and what they are looking for. One has to coordinate expectations with the limits of the reality.
Now, a listener left a comment, wonders, is it true that the great acoustics of Carnegie Hall are an accident, that the builders just got lucky? Or are the acoustics so great? Because weren't there concerns some years back that it was very trebly, but it was hard to hear bass notes?
Years ago, hard to hear bass notes? Not at all.
Oh, okay. Maybe it was bass notes you couldn't hear Dremel. I can't remember.
Not in my experience, anyway. But Tuthill was this amateur architect who was given the commission to design the hall because he was the treasurer of the chorale that Mrs. Carnegie was part of. And Carnegie sent Tuthill on a year-long tour of Europe to visit the greatest halls so that he would learn. And he was a cellist himself, so he was very sensitive to sound. The biggest problems he had was the span that Carl was talking about, because he had to calculate the new steel trusses. And he actually didn't attend the opening because he was afraid the balconies were going to collapse.
Well, Victoria, the problem actually was after the building was rebuilt to some degree in 85, 86, wasn't it?
That's correct. I'm not really up on all the details, but I think there was a space that was filled in underneath the stage.
Yes, concrete. There were two things. Yes. When Stokowski did a film with Deanna Durbin, 101 Men and a Woman, I think it was named, they broke through the ceiling on the stage of Carnegie Hall in order to have the cameras have an overhead view, and they never filled it in. And underneath the stage, nobody knows when this happened, but somehow a huge amount of concrete was poured. So that was discovered just in when they were cleaning up the renovation, and that turned into a huge project.
Now, why is this all that important? Couldn't we just use amplification to some degree if we use it discreetly? Do we have to have opera singers singing for the last row?
Well, Renee Fleming said to me recently that she feels that her kind of performance, which is always natural acoustics, unassisted by any kind of amplification, is kind of the last personal connection between the performer and the audience, unlike Broadway shows, which are always amplified, of course. And she feels very strongly that she does not want any kind of amplification because of this direct contact between a human being, a performer, and the person listening.
It's more natural sounding.
Absolutely. As soon as you apply power to the situation, you change the equation of the music. And one can do it with subtlety, as you say, but the likelihood of it being done subtly is extremely low, and it's much more likely to have an honest performance if you just rely totally on acoustics.
In that TED talk I mentioned earlier on architectural acoustics, David Byrne said that certain types of venues are responsible for giving us power ballads and other mid-tempo rock and pop tunes because they're the kinds of songs that sound good in these spaces. Do we really have stadium designers to thank for U2 and Coldplay?
They're a lot of fun, those concerts, that's for sure.
But it does democratize art, doesn't it? And that happened first with recorded music and then radio, and now even worse, those tiny laptop speakers.
Well, I think that, you know, one of the things about many of the new theaters is that they are much more flexible. And so you are not stuck with a fixed, like the Musique Verein or Carnegie Hall, for example. You're not stuck with this very strict architectural arrangement. You can play around with it. You can play around with the way the stage is going to be laid out, with the way the audience is going to be positioned around it. In Miami, the Frank Gehry concert hall that we mentioned earlier, they actually have four high platforms that can be used to switch from one kind of performance to another. So, for example, if the orchestra has just performed a symphony, instead of waiting for all of those musicians to go off the stage with their instruments, the spotlight, in a second, simply switches to a platform where you have maybe a soloist.
Victoria Newhouse, Raphael Mostel, Carl Rosenberg, and others will be discussing architecture and the experience of music tonight at 6 o'clock at 1 East 78th Street. For more information and to RSVP, go to our show page at WNYC.org. The book, Sight and Sound, is published by the Monticelli Press. Thank you all so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.